Welcome to the Manitoba Ag Days podcast, where we hear from some of the most relevant, up-to-date, informational speakers in our industry. In episode 23, Dr. David Lobb, professor at the University of Manitoba, tells his story, managing surface water on farm to achieve both agricultural and environmental benefits.
Well, thank you, Mitch, and good morning, everybody. It's my pleasure to be here to speak to you about some of the issues around watershed management across these fence lines, some of the challenges and the opportunities. Before I get into the presentation, I just want to recognize Wanda McFadden, our Executive Director for the Assiniboine River Basin Initiative. Wanda does yeoman's work in getting some of these presentations ready, and I'll try to do justice to the work she's done in preparing this presentation. A bit of an advance warning and a disclaimer. The disclaimer is, as Mitch indicated, I'm a retired veterinarian, and I'm not a hydrologist, I'm not an engineer, so why I'm engaged in water, I'll try to explain very briefly. The warning as well is that I'll probably step on a few toes through my presentation this morning with some comments, but if those comments stimulate some productive discussion and debate, then it's all worthwhile. Everyone does indeed have an opinion when it comes to water issues. So why am I involved in this? I've lived and worked in the Assiniboine River Basin all my life. I farm right alongside the Arrow River. And an interesting fact for you, in 2017, a year that was not necessarily a flood year, the monitoring gauges near Mineota, where the Arrow River goes into the Assiniboine, registered the highest flows on record for that little creek. Now that in itself is a bit of a disturbing factor, and it makes me wonder sometimes whether we're managing our land and water resources the way they should be. I have a strong desire to try and leave our land and water resources for the next generation in a better state than what we received it, and that's a large part of what the Assiniboine River Basin Initiative is all about. A quote attributed to Mark Twain, "Whiskey's for drinking and water's for fighting over." Today's goal is to try to find a way to outline a different approach so we don't have quite as many wars. Just a few examples of some of those fights that are going on as we speak. We've got ongoing issues here in Manitoba with the Assiniboine Valley producers and the operation of the Shellmouth Dam. That's been happening for 20-some years now. Look across the border to North Dakota, and the province of Manitoba is battling North Dakota right now on the issue of providing Missouri water into the rural pipelines in North Dakota. At the same time, ironically, the state of Missouri is also in a fight with North Dakota with regards to access for Missouri River waters. A little closer to home, if we look at the situation in Saskatchewan with the Quill Lake issue, the Pasqua First Nation is challenging the Saskatchewan Water Security Agency regarding the requirement or lack thereof to have an environmental assessment done. So there's lots of these fights going on around. We do like to fight over water. I'd prefer to drink the whiskey and try to come to a more collaborative approach to how we move things forward. A bit of an overview of what I want to do this morning. I want to talk about some of the platitudes regarding water. I want to give you a bit of an update on the Assiniboine River Basin Initiative, some of the activities we're engaged in. I want to talk a bit about the problems and the potential solutions. As Mitch indicated, we'll touch on the Manitoba Foraging Grasslands Association Aquati Project, and again, hopefully stimulate some discussion. Water is a driving force in nature. Leonardo da Vinci, back in the 14th century, talked about how important water was to life, and indeed it is, and we sometimes forget that fact. We forget that Canada and Manitoba are blessed with a bountiful supply of water that instead of treating as a resource, we sometimes treat as a nuisance and impediment to production. Water covers almost three-quarters of the Earth's surface, but only a small amount of that water is non-saline and available for our use. By 2025, there'll be a vast majority of the world's population will be facing some sort of water-based vulnerability. There are a whole range of these transboundary watershed groups in place across the country, everybody trying to achieve those same sort of nebulous and hard-to-achieve goals. This is a complicated slide. I won't spend any time on it other than to indicate that one-third of Canadians depend on groundwater as the source of their fresh water. If you look at Manitoba, it's a little hard to make it out, but it's about 35-38% of Manitobans rely on groundwater for their water. So again, these are important little tidbits that remind us how valuable this resource is. If you take nothing else away from this talk this morning, remember water's golden rule. It's very simple. Do unto those downstream as you would have those upstream do unto you. In the presentations you just heard, we talked about contacting and getting consent from landowners 2 miles downstream from our project. It's vitally important that we continue to use that element as we move various projects forward. In the past, sometimes we've gone too far down the road of doing what we think is right for us on our little piece of land or our own backyard. If we use the golden rule, we'd be much further ahead. The other concept that I'd like you to take home from this discussion this morning is that of social license. That's a term that's been bannered about quite a bit in the last number of years, but it ties back into water's golden rule. Social license indicates that we need the approval of society at large to move forward with some of the things that we want to do on our own property. We often hear talk about having science-based decision-making processes, and I'm a strong believer in that as well. But in the terms of social license, you better expand the science to look at social science and political science, not just the hard, cold facts of a science-based decision-making process. Again, let me repeat, we have an obligation as landowners to responsibly manage the resource that we have. We're caretakers of that resource, and indeed, we want to make sure as we move forward that we have done our due diligence and generations coming after will not criticize us for what we have done. A few quick comments about the Assiniboine River Basin Initiative, starting with the big picture with the Lake Winnipeg watershed. It's a huge watershed stemming all the way from the Rocky Mountains to downtown Winnipeg, and the Assiniboine River Basin is indeed a part of that group. So we zoom in on this Assiniboine River Basin, and in actual fact, part of the reason I'm engaged in this file and part of the reason why the Assiniboine River Basin Initiative has moved forward is that this was an orphan. This particular component of the watershed did not have an organizational structure, did not have much input as to what's going on in the bigger picture of things, and it now has moved into that situation. The Assiniboine River Basin includes both all of the Qu'Appelle, the Souris, and the Assiniboine proper. Covers an area roughly the size of the state of North Dakota. Interestingly enough, there's about 1.5 million people make their homes and their livings in this basin. The agricultural GDP alone for the Assiniboine River Basin is in the region of $10 billion. And as we all know, there's a wide range of natural resources within that basin: oil, natural gas, potash, and coal. There's a whole host of various organizations that are involved in the Assiniboine River Basin. I'm not going to go through these in detail. Just want to point out that as you work your way down that list, you'll see that there is no one single organization that has sort of an overarching influence within the basin. And that's where the Assiniboine River Basin Commission initiative comes into play. We span the provincial border between Manitoba and Saskatchewan, obviously. We also span the international border into the United States. And our entire purpose, our raison d'etre, if you like, is to facilitate watershed management across those many boundaries, across those many fence lines. Just take a moment to consider the various structures within the Assiniboine River Basin that were built to manage some of the water issues ranging from flood to drought. In Manitoba, we have the Shellmouth Dam in the Lake of the Prairies. We have the Portage Diversion that we all are familiar with. Probably less familiar are the structures in Saskatchewan, including the Rafferty Dam, the Alameda Dam, and the Boundary Dam, along with a host of smaller structures along the Qu'Appelle River, all designed to help manage water flows. And in North Dakota, we've got Lake Darling. These structures, and this is a pretty hard map to read, but these structures do indeed have a significant play in how water is managed. And I guess part of our concern as Arby is to make sure that the operation of these structures is managed and coordinated in keeping with water's golden rule. Sometimes Manitoba makes its own decisions, Saskatchewan makes its own decisions, North Dakota likewise makes its own decisions, and they don't necessarily always talk to each other like they should. Just think of the elevation changes within this watershed. from Moose Jaw to Winnipeg, we dropped from 577 meters to 229 meters, a 350-meter drop over some 700 kilometers. In case there's any question about it, water does indeed run downhill. What happens at the Lake Diefenbaker Inlet into this watershed has an influence at the Forks in downtown Winnipeg. We've been through a couple of recent flood events, and I'm not going to dwell on those to any great degree, other than to give you a little piece of history that I meant to do at the outset. I'll come back to it now. I've been looking at Bill Redekop's book recently about the Lake Agassiz situation. There's a chapter in there called Our Big Flood. The big flood was in 1826. That flood exceeded the flood of the century in 1997 by a considerable margin. The really interesting thing to me when we look back at that history is that the flood of 1826 took place before there was much, if any, agricultural development in the basin. Took place long before the first shovel was put in the ground to dig a ditch, and yet we had a flood that rivaled anything that's happened since. Just reminds us that the management of water is not as simple as we might think. In terms of these flood events, again, not to dwell on it, but 2011 was a signature event for this corner of the province in particular. The 2014 event was more of a rainfall event, but the issues continued to cause us problems. And I think part of the problem rests with the aspect of how much in-channel storage capacity we've got and how we match that storage capacity to the amount of water that is going through the system. Another slide that talks about the flip side of that version, drought events. I think we've been so focused on floods in the last number of years that we've forgotten that weather cycles, climate cycles do indeed go back and forth, and drought events may be something that will come back to haunt us as well. This year we're in at the present time, for example. If you look at soil maps that were just put out in the last couple of weeks, you'll see that virtually all of the prairies is in a drought scenario. The subsurface water levels and water tables that took us through last year and gave us some pretty outstanding yields are simply not there this year. That water is not in the ground, and at the present time, the snow cover is not building that level back up for us. If you listen to some of the experts on the whole issue of drought and drought management, including people like Dave Sochin at the University of Regina, he talks about tree ring data that brings us to the realization that these drought cycles can run on a 25-year basis. We barely survived as a society a 7 or 8 year drought cycle in the 30s. Are we at all prepared to manage a 25-year drought? I'm not sure that we are. Back to the basin again. What's been going on in our basin in the last little while? I'm not gonna walk through these in a great deal of detail, other than indicate that as an organization, we pride ourselves on and being coordinators, being those who cooperate, those who communicate to make sure that with all of our partners throughout the basin, we can make some progress on some of these various topics. A bit of history about why this organization was established. As I said in my earlier comments, the Assiniboine River Basin was kind of an orphan. It was kind of forgotten in terms of its input into the overall Lake Winnipeg watershed. So starting back in 2008 and then leaping forward to 2013 and 2014, we put together this organization to make sure that the Assiniboine River Basin issues and challenges were indeed part of the overall water mix. Take a moment, and I'll have to get a little closer so I can see through my blurry glasses here, but take a moment to consider the vision and mission statements. A resilient Assiniboine River Basin where stakeholders work together to achieve basin-wide comprehensive watershed actions that will benefit present and future generations. In the mission statement, that word resilience shows up again, as does the discussion about sustainability. Very, very important to our organization that we focus on resiliency and that we focus on that three-legged stool of sustainability, including environmental, economic, and social aspects of that. Guiding principles that our organization works to move forward with. We're looking at fair and equitable solutions for all parties. We want to balance current and future needs, acknowledge that things are changing on the landscape and we have to continue to adapt. most importantly, work across these jurisdictional boundaries and work collaboratively with all of our stakeholders. We put together a framework plan, which is, in essence, is a roadmap for the organization going forward in terms of trying to address some key areas. Again, I won't belabor you by reading through all of those key issues, but you'll see that drainage-related topics sits pretty close to the top. Water quality is an extremely important concern for everybody within the basin, especially those areas that rely on groundwater for their potable water source. Wetland preservation and reconstruction, an important component for this organization and for the entities that are involved in it. And again, the list goes on. Those are the sort of things that are built into our framework, and they form the basis of our work plan on a year-to-year basis. Some of the goals for this organization that were set out at the outset, and these of course change and moderate with time. But again, as I said before, one of the issues is trying to reduce water flows through the system to a level that the stream infrastructure can handle. There's a lot of discussion about creating multiple disseminated water storage locations throughout the basin, again, to meter how that water leaves the land and moves into the system. The next one probably is a flag that will cause the most discussion, reducing and managing drainage. Probably should take the word reduce out and look at the word manage. And again, the discussion we just had this morning with regard to how tile drainage fits into that system, slowing down the movement of water off the land, ties in quite nicely. Water quality, I've addressed that already. It's an important component that we have to continue to deal with on a regular basis. Water quality monitoring takes place at the international boundary with the service going into the U.S. and the service coming back into Canada. More of that type of water quality monitoring needs to take place. Salinity impacts, we've heard about that again this morning, again, an important element of improving the quality of our land and soil. Sharing water fairly and equitably. That generally hasn't been an issue up until recent times. In fact, we sometimes wish that our neighbors wouldn't share quite as much water with us. But as we move forward into what may be the beginning of a drought cycle, that appropriation and sharing of water will become more of an issue. You heard the word LIDAR used this morning. We're encouraging the development of LIDAR data across the basin, making that information available to planners to make their decisions as they move forward. And of course, conducting a basin-wide hydrological analysis, and I'll touch a little more on that particular project in a couple of minutes. But as I said before, I'm a veterinarian and a gentleman farmer. I'm not a hydrologist or an engineer, so I like to boil things down into pretty simple steps. Really, there's only three issues with water that we need to deal with. One is the situation where there's too much of it. The second is where there's too little, and the whole water quality issue that ties into both of those. And it's certainly a firm conviction of mine that if we do a good job of addressing the issues of quantity, the issues of quality start to take care of themselves to some degree. I've already spoken about this issue of in-stream bed water storage. Going back into the 60s when the Shellmouth Dam was built and the dams in Saskatchewan were built, they served multi-functions, but one of the primary functions was to reduce floods and store water for drought situations. And again, I think as we move forward, we need to find better ways to increase that storage capacity. We're not going to build any more Shellmouth dams. We're not going to see huge project of that nature moving forward, but we are going to see water storage on the landscape in a much more simplistic, coordinated, and small basis. We need to look and learn from others. We've got our colleagues in the Red River Basin Commission in the audience this morning, so I apologize at the outset if I got some of these facts wrong, and they can correct me later. But basically, there was a goal put in place to reduce the flow in the Red at Emerson by some 20%. A large project funded through the U.S. Farm Bill. What eventually took place, that there was a significant number of acres of land in the North Ottawa project that were developed to provide that disseminated water storage and wetland conservation and preservation. No question that's had a huge impact. And I guess from my perspective with the Assiniboine River Basin Initiative, can we do something similar in our neck of the woods to reduce those flows? I'm going to switch gears now and talk a little about decision support tools that help us to move forward with some of the projects that we need to look at with regards to water management. We need better decision-making tools. There's a whole host of them on the horizon and in play already. But the one that is exciting me the most at the present time is the Manitoba Forage and Grasslands Association Equanti project. Hats off to Duncan Morrison, the executive director of MFGA, Dave Kozlowski, the chairman of the board, and project leader Henry Nelson for their foresight and their leadership in undertaking and delivering this massive project. I'm not going to delve into too much detail on the model because I'll get in over my head and start making mistakes and displaying my lack of knowledge of the engineering principles. But the key factor about this model that is probably different from a host of other models that are available is that it includes surface water, it includes groundwater, it includes weather-related precipitation. The list goes on and on. There's something in the realm of a couple of million data points that have been researched and entered into the database for this project to produce what is referred to as a hydrogeospheric model. Make no mistake, this project was funded primarily through the Agri-Risk Initiatives component of Agriculture and Agri-Food Canada for one basic reason. And that basic reason is that the governments, whether they be federal or provincial, have been funneling huge amounts of money into water-related damages over the last number of years, and the Agri-Risk Initiatives program was looking to find a way to manage those risks, mitigate those risks, and mitigate those ad hoc payments. This is just a slide that talks about the hydrogeospheric model, and again, I won't go into a lot of detail there other than to indicate that as we stock this model with data from throughout the basin, it becomes a very detailed, in fact, incredibly detailed model that allows us to utilize it in terms of scenarios going forward, what-if situations as to how we might manage the basin in a more holistic fashion. The project has two very clear objectives. The first one was to develop this detailed hydrogeospheric model for the complete Assiniboine River Basin, and that component is virtually completed. March 31st is the date when the project reaches its final stages. The second piece, driven by Manitoba Forage and Grasslands Association, was to explore how increased acres of perennial crops and forages could mitigate the damages caused by both flood and drought. And this is where it gets interesting and fairly exciting, trying to figure out what sort of scenarios we can present to the model and ask for its guidance in terms of how we move forward. I want to stress that the model is not a predictor of floods or a predictor of droughts. It's a decision support tool that helps us look at ways to mitigate those various scenarios. Can't go through a talk about MFGA and the Equanti model without throwing up the slide that Henry Nelson and others like to use just to demonstrate pictorially what a difference can be made in the environment by using perennial crops and perennial forages as compared to annual crops. As you move across that slide, you'll see the large root system for those perennial crops going way, way down into the soil. You'll see, by contrast, on the other side of the equation, the much more shallow root system for the annual crops. Again, these it's not a simplistic answer to all of our situations, but there's no question that perennial forages and grasses do have the opportunity to open up that soil structure and allow water to both percolate down and to percolate back up out of that system to maintain crops through the year. This is an assembled 3D model of this Equanti project that has been put together. It loses some of its punch on a two-dimensional slide, but I think Duncan probably has the actual model with him and could demonstrate or show it to you. But again, it just indicates that with this three-dimensional model, we can certainly begin to build in scenarios where we can look at how this model would help allow us to access more information and move the agenda forward. Before I get to this slide, one of the there are a couple of aspects of the project that I neglected to touch upon. One component was to drill down very critically on the Birdtail Creek component of the watershed, a much smaller sub-watershed within the larger Assiniboine River Basin. And again, that work is proceeding fairly quickly. The second piece that we're just engaging on right now is working with Verdon and the Upper Assiniboine River Conservation District to look at the Scallion Creek and some of the issues around it with regards to flood implications. You'll recall in 2014 that we came within a hair's breadth of having number one highway closed and out of business in the Verdon area because of floodwaters. So these two areas are ones that we want to address a little more thoroughly. We also want to address some of the concerns in urban areas. This picture before you is the 2014 aerial view of the flood in the Brannan area along the Assiniboine River. And again, the Aquanti model is not just about agricultural land, it's about urban issues and urban concerns as well. In closing, we want to kind of echo Bob Sanford's comments. Bob's kind of a guru of water management, holistic water management, and I think the key element that he talks about in there is very complementary to the Assiniboine River Basin Initiative, talking about how we could very well be the leaders in this revolution. The pieces are in place to move forward with cooperation between jurisdictions across these national, international, and local boundaries. As I said before, the Assiniboine River Basin Initiative is a coordinator, a joiner, a communicator with that overriding goal of facilitating and supporting a coordinated approach to water and land-related issues in the basin. With that, I'll throw up the contact information for Wanda and her office in Winnipeg, along with the Twitter and Facebook accounts. And that will terminate my remarks. Mitch, if there are any comments or questions from the audience, I would certainly welcome them.
All right, thank you, Alan. And yes, I'm going to, why don't I see if I fire this one up, Scott, as well. Green light is on, so it's on. Okay, very good. So I'll leave that one for Alan and invite questions from the audience. We have lots of time for discussion. Yes, sir. The question is regarding financial contributions to the RB effort. Alan, would you like to break that down at all?
Sure. Just in broad strokes, we're working with about $160,000 per year budget. Got to be brutally frank and honest. I will answer your question. There's a disproportionate funding process at the present time. We have asked from the outset for contributions at the state and provincial level. Manitoba was the first to jump in with a contribution of an annual contribution of $50,000 back in 2014, and they have continued an annual contribution since that time. In fact, the Assiniboine River Basin Initiative, along with the Red River Basin Commission, are now identified within the statutes that were just passed last fall. North Dakota has been a extremely valuable and supportive partner from the outset. The North Dakota State Water Commission also provides us with a $50,000 per year fund to work our way through some of these issues. The City of Minot and Ward County around Minot have also been generous contributors, and there are many other smaller organizations in both Manitoba and Saskatchewan, Manitoba and North Dakota, that are contributing. The elephant in the room is Saskatchewan. We've had many, many discussions with the folks at the Water Security Agency along with other elected officials, and to date have not had the support that we would like from Saskatchewan. Having said that, I'll lose track of my exact dates, but I guess it would have been in December of 2014. We sat down with the Water Security Agency, and the reception would be what I would refer to as being very cool. We got to say our piece, they listened politely and then showed us the door. We went back a year later and the mood had changed dramatically. The folks at Water Security Agency had come to recognize the valuable work that the Assiniboine River Basin Initiative was doing. They indicated that they were supportive of our activities, but, and always a but, the well was dry and there was no money forthcoming. We're going back to Saskatchewan in a couple of weeks for our annual conference and for a sit-down session with the folks at Water Security Agency. And I truly hope, and maybe I've got rose-colored glasses, but I truly hope that they will find a way to find some funding. One of the issues that has kind of slowed us down a bit is there's been a revolving door of ministers at the Water Security Agency, with Saskatchewan Environment, who controls the Water Security Agency. And with the current leadership program going on, several of the folks who would be sitting in that chair at Environment are out on the hustings trying to become the next leader, the next premier for Saskatchewan. So a long-winded answer to your question. We've got excellent support in Manitoba, North Dakota, reasonably good local support in Saskatchewan, no support yet in terms of dollars from the provincial government itself.
Yes, supplemental. The invitation is to anyone who happens to be here from our neighboring province to the west, and specifically the Water Agency. That would be great if someone was representing the agency in the room and willing to declare.
If I was representing WSA, I would not identify myself at this point. But having said that, all joking aside, Wanda's on her way to Moosomin this afternoon to have a meeting with the managers of the conservation districts from the Manitoba side of the border, the Water Stewardship Associations from the Saskatchewan side of the boundary, to discuss a number of these issues in a very frank and open format. Tomorrow afternoon, we're holding another meeting in Verdon, where we've invited politicians of all stripes. We've got a couple of members of parliament coming. We've got several MLAs on both sides of the border attending, and a number of municipal officials from the municipalities that are on that western side of the border, from Manitoba's perspective, the eastern side from Saskatchewan. The emphasis of that Trans Boundary discussion is again to share information, encourage everybody to be singing from the same song sheet, break down the barriers that exist. So again, I use the rose-colored glasses comment again. I think we are making progress, and hopefully that meeting will be productive and not be one where we spend all of our time complaining about what's been going on in the past. There's an old adage about there's a reason why the rearview mirror is quite small and the windshield is quite large. There's more to be gained by looking forward through that big windshield than looking back over my shoulder in the rearview mirror.
Good line. That might have to become your bumper sticker. Is that? Oh, that's probably too much, Alan. Sorry. Yes, sir. Go ahead. The question is regarding the portage diversion and the outlet to alleviate flooding risk on Lake Manitoba. Alan, do you have any comment or redirect to the right people involved?
Well, I'll start and others can chime in and correct me where I'm wrong, but basically way back in, I guess, 1958, when Duff Roblin suggested that the floodway should be built around Winnipeg, the other two pieces of that puzzle were the Portage Diversion and the Shellmouth Dam. The Shellmouth Dam was built in circa 1960. The diversion at Portage, I'm not sure whether it was in that time frame, but it would be close, I think, to the early 60s. 1970, my source of wisdom over here tells me. Thanks, Henry. As far as your questions about the Lake St. Martin diversion, This is where I step on some people's toes and go out on a limb, but that's okay. I'm not elected. I can be fired, but I can't be censored in any other fashion. I think the number of dollars that are targeted for that diversion are something in the region of $1 billion at the present time, if not more. From my perspective, I would rather take that $1 billion and apply it back throughout the watershed to reduce the flows that are coming down the Assiniboine and reduce the need to use the Portage diversion to the extent that's already there. I realize that the politics come into play, and there's a whole lot of other factors that would need to be put into discussion. But again, this diversion, in my mind, is a money pit that is taking dollars away that could be used elsewhere in the system for a better purpose. We're in the process of working with the International Institute for Sustainable Development right now on a project that to cut it down into very simplistic terms looks at how much disseminated storage would have been required in the Assiniboine River Basin in 2011 to reduce, mitigate, or perhaps even eliminate some of the significant damage we saw from that flood. Be interesting to see what that number is, but I'm willing to bet that the outcome will show that building that disseminated storage approach, much as the Red River Basin Commission has done, would be much cheaper than expanding our capacity to manage floodwaters. I can't comment on the water quality issues you've talked about. There are others who may have more knowledge than me on that topic. But again, from my perspective, it's become very much a political football, and it's going to end up costing that $1 billion or more and not necessarily contributing a whole lot to our overall ability to manage water within the watershed. Anybody else want to chime in on that one?
Thank you, Alan. Yeah, anything further on that topic? If not, what I would invite is one more question unfettered, and then maybe one more after that, if there is one, during the switch to Dr. Lobb's file. Yes, sir. The question is about LIDAR, vital piece of information for this type of work, and whether or not there's an open source possibility to engage others who might otherwise be missed but have something to offer. Alan, has this ever come up in the deliberations?
When we embarked as a partner with the MFGA on the Aquanti project, we were very clear, or at least I think we were very clear, that the Aquanti model and the approach that it takes to dealing with water management issues is just one of many decision support tools. LIDAR falls in that same category as far as I'm concerned. It's vitally important, a vital component of moving the agenda forward. But as an organization, we certainly keep our eyes and our ears wide open to whatever might be coming in terms of a new and interesting technology. Again, our colleagues in North Dakota in particular, with the work that's been done in the resiliency capacity building in Minot, have relied on other types of models, other types of information. Our organization is wide open to those at any point in time, and we encourage discussions along the line that you've talked about. There's always a but, and the but that comes in for us is that funding restricts what we can and can't do. We've got a wonderful staff of one who runs the organization for us. We struggle to have enough dollars to keep operating on an annual basis, and taking on any large projects would require some partnerships, and we'll keep our eyes open to those potential partnerships and potential funding opportunities, but I can't comment beyond that, Barry.
All right, any last question before we switch over? If not, then please join me in thanking Dr. Preston one last time.
Thanks for tuning in to the Manitoba Ag Days podcast. We'll see you next year from January 22nd to 24th, 2019.